Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Ian, great to be with you.
Well, thanks, Scott. And what do you make of this possibility that I just was talking with Sumi Terry about, that Vladimir Putin's going to come out of this thing looking like a world statesman if, you know, Trump continues this bluster and tweeting? And, of course, Kim Jong-un has called Trump's bluff. He threatened to rain fire and fury down on North Korea, and nothing's happened. Instead, the North Koreans have upped the ante and made the President of the United States look foolish, which is something he doesn't enjoy. And then you've got the former head of the CIA and the NSA, General Hayden, saying today on CNN that, quote, "Mr. President, this is not a manhood issue. This is a national security issue. Don't let your pride get in the way of wise policy here." So if you combine that statement with an earlier statement by the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Corker, questioning Trump's stability, I don't know how else you can interpret stability, but mental stability, I think a lot of people on our side are nervous. And by contrast, Putin could be the sober steward of Russia's vast nuclear arsenal.
Well, I think that's exactly right. So there's a great deal of speculation, discussion inside of Russia involving commentators and pundits about this. Of course, the Putin's own statement was fairly dramatic and got heavy attention in the media there, as here. But simultaneously, Russian media, over the last 48 hours, we've seen a number of people talk about how unpredictable, how fickle, and indeed how childlike Trump is. And this is being said in connection with the developments of North Korea, where there is really widespread concern that the very volatile situation there may deteriorate into war, indeed even into a nuclear confrontation. And I think inside of Russia, people close to Putin see this as an opportunity for him to demonstrate his statesman qualities, that, you know, he can step into this gap right now, use his very positive personal relationship with Trump and attempt to broker something and try and calm the situation down. And I think we'd have to note by way of background that Russia has, we usually think of China as being the major power with close ties and influence in Pyongyang, which is true. But Russia also has a long historical relationship with the North Korean regime and has been protective and supportive of that regime, certainly during the Soviet period. But after the Soviet period, things changed very little. Russia continued to be a major vendor of arms and technology. Russia also allowed the North Koreans to operate slave labor camps, to fell wood and mine on Russian territory. And we have to note that, indeed, Russia historically has had a very substantial Korean population. In fact, the eastern province Primorye of the Russian Federation, a large part of that province historically was Korean and is occupied by Koreans. So if there were a conflagration on the Korean peninsula, that would directly affect one of Russia's largest cities, Vladivostok, which is just a short hop away, as well as their entire east coast, their eastern coastal province, which is extremely important for Russia. So for all these reasons, I think there's very, very strong interest in it, and they're seeing in the conflict a possibility for some dramatic action by Putin. So we'll see how this develops.
And again, I'm speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a wide variety of journalists and whistleblowers. So, Scott, the 9th annual summit of the BRICS, which is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, has begun. And today, Sunday in China, is the two-day conference is beginning. And Russia's President Vladimir Putin, again, ahead of this conference, published an article warning that the North Korean crisis is, quote, on the brink of large-scale conflict. He's also been tweeting out that tensions, quote, are balancing on the brink of large-scale conflict. So that's Putin is making that clear. In contrast, what Donald Trump is saying is that the U.S. has been talking to North Korea and paying them extortion money for 25 years. Talking is not the answer. So you couldn't have more of a contrast there. Speaking earlier with Sumi Terry, it was very clear that the idea of relying on China all the time is just absurd. First of all, the Chinese, I mean, the first thing that Kim Jong-un did was to murder his uncle because he was the liaison to China. Then he murdered his older half-brother because he was under Chinese protection and the Chinese were possibly going to organize a coup to install Kim's older half-brother. So there's no love lost between North Korea and China, surely.
That's exactly right. In fact, I'd say, you know, it's not called the Hermit Kingdom for nothing. You know, it is difficult to understand, but it also has difficult relations even with its closest friends. And China and Russia will probably be reckoned the closest friends of North Korea. So they're close. They have proximity. They have personal relations with many powerful figures there. But their ability to influence the leadership of the country is actually quite limited.
So what do you think's going on in general with Putin? Apart from, I mean, I obviously want to talk about the BRICS conference because that's a pretty substantial group of countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And they could play an important role in dampening down this situation. But in general, my understanding, and I think you've just gotten back from Italy, I believe that our European allies, particularly the Germans, who are about to re-elect Angela Merkel, I think, by a huge margin, but the Italians are very unhappy with these sanctions against Russia. And I think Putin and Merkel have been in much more contact lately. So do you think Putin can exploit the disquiet that our Western European allies have about Trump, who never really, you know, gave any kind of full-throated endorsement to Article 5 of the NATO Treaty and has been said this craziest stuff, insulted allies, praised Putin endlessly, and in general been very unsettling. So is that, do you think that's a landscape that Putin can exploit?
Yes, I mean, I think there are plenty of openings for Putin in the relationship with Europe, and I think the Europeans, you know, while they're very distressed about his dealings with Ukraine, and I think there still is a consensus for some level of sanctions, there's also a concern to keep all of this within certain reasonable limits, not to allow it to escalate into broader warfare, and to find a longer-term modus vivendi with Russia. And I think that's pretty broad. I think Merkel, too, I think Putin really wanted to take Merkel out. He wanted to see a reshuffling of the deck in Germany that would bring people who were more palatable to him and Russian interests to the fore, maybe the Social Democrats or some coalition with them in the lead. I think right now he recognizes that's not going to happen. I mean, Merkel's on course for a fourth term. She'll be in a stronger position, according to all the polls now, than she's been after any of the prior elections. So she's dominant, and she and Macron will be dominant for Europe. But let's flip it around and look at the situation inside of Russia. So Putin's headed for another election. Nobody doubts he's going to be reelected. Of course he's going to be reelected. He is already the longest-serving Russian leader since Joseph Stalin. That's quite an accomplishment. I mean, he came to power in 1999. He's been the paramount leader ever since, sometimes as prime minister, sometimes as president, but nevertheless the man who really called all the shots. No one thinks that the electoral process is going to result in someone else coming in. On the other hand, there's also a lot of discussion inside of Russia about the succession game and how will this play out. There's a lot of expectation that he'll be around for several more years, but he's not going to be around forever. There is going to be some sort of turnover. That's also been a constant in Russian history. And I'd say there's a pretty high level of dissatisfaction with the way Putin has managed things domestically. So, and you're talking about the BRICS. There were high expectations for Russia and for the Russian economy. Those expectations have not been realized. Russia has been a pretty dramatic underperformer, and a lot of that is because of Putin's own decision to place all his bets on the hydrocarbons and natural resources sector and not to diversify the Russian economy. And I think we're in the position right now where most of the Russian intelligentsia, most of the bankers and professionals, view him as a strong and admirable leader in some respects, but also a person who's really made some very stupid calls about economic development. I think we're going to be seeing over the next few years a focus on succession, and I think Putin and his own advisors are intent now on changing their game a little bit to try and build confidence with those elites who are essential for his continued rule. So I think a changed attitude towards Europe, I think something dramatic in East Asia, like with Korea, where he demonstrates he can be a peacemaker and someone bringing stability to a situation that's threatened by an unpredictable American leader, those would be strong positive changes for him.
Well, I think it's pretty clear that if Putin had the role that U.S. intelligence is accusing of in meddling in the 2016 elections, then he made a bad bet. And my understanding was that some of the more sober, experienced senior KGB officers, like his former chief of staff, Ivanov, former KGB general, and after all, you remember, Putin himself was a minor apparatchik in the KGB, stuck in East Germany. The talented people tended to go to Bonn, London, New York, and Washington. So if he was behind that, as he's been accused of by U.S. intelligence, the meddling in our elections, then that certainly has backfired. He's worse off now than ever, and as you point out, he's worse off in Europe. He didn't succeed in interfering or changing the elections in the Netherlands, in France, and now in Germany. So right across the board, things have not gone well for him. Is there a debate going on? This is what I'm hearing, that there's some kind of debate going on between the people who advised Putin against the U.S. operation, the Ivanov types, that they're back in ascendancy, and the hardliners and the young Turks who ignored their warnings about blowback are on the defensive, or is this all landing on Putin's lap?
Well, it's very difficult to see who's on top in these debates inside the Kremlin and inside the power structures of the country. But it is clear that we have had the people there have had different views about the active measures campaign. And it's also clear that there are people right now in Russia who are very critical of helping Trump based on the way Trump himself behaves. So I guess it's one thing to damage America's alliance system, to damage NATO. Maybe that's a positive. But if it leads to a nuclear war or a serious tactical war on Russia's doorstep in Korea, that's not a good thing. That's a terrible thing. So I think there is certainly a lot of compunction about this, a lot of hesitation about it. And we see that being played out in Russian media. So immediately after the election, Russian state media was extremely positive on Trump. He was viewed as our man. It was viewed as a victory for Russia in the election. And I think, three or four months into his administration, we saw equivocation of that. And just in the last couple of weeks, we've seen, particularly on Channel 1 Russian TV, some exceptionally harsh criticism of Trump, in which, he's being flagged as a warmonger who could launch some sort of global nuclear war that would be a tragedy for everyone. That's pretty heavy. And something like that doesn't happen on Russian TV without people way up the political ladder giving a green light for it to happen.
Well, just to go back to Putin's article that he wrote on the eve of this BRICS conference starting in China on Sunday, Putin, in reference to the North Korean crisis, and this was before they let off their thermonuclear weapon, Putin said, "Provocations, pressure, and bellicose and offensive rhetoric is the road to nowhere." He accused the United States of that it was misguided and futile for the U.S. to keep putting pressure on North Korea through imposing tougher sanctions to stop its nuclear program. So now, as I say, it looks as though Kim Jong-un has called Trump's bluff. Trump is the one that's cornered, isn't he?
I think so. I mean, frankly, you look at that that statement that Putin issued, and not 100% of it, but 80% of it, I could imagine coming from Secretary Mattis or Secretary Tillerson. It's also their message that in times like this, facing a crisis of this magnitude, you have to be clear, forthright, transparent. You don't make wild threats, and you don't deal with it by issuing off-the-cuff Twitter comments. What's really required is caution. I think that's the essence of Putin's message as well. And I think Beijing and Moscow also feel a measure of threat coming from the latest escalation. I mean, so particularly the successful launch of longer-range missiles, and now the detonation of a thermonuclear device, that changes the dynamics of this problem dramatically.
Well, it does seem that we're in a situation now where the, as I said, the U.S. seems to, or Trump seems to have trapped himself, hoisted himself on his own bluster and rhetoric, and he's the North Korean leader has called his bluff. You mentioned the generals, and there is, I think, perhaps even a false comfort that the generals are somehow able to restrain him. Apparently, Trump chafes under the whatever Kelly is trying to do to organize the White House, and he still seems to be getting some bizarre advice, even though some of the crazier people like Bannon and Gawker have been eased out. There's still Stephen Miller there. I mean, Stephen Miller is, I think, behind this possible revocation of DACA on Tuesday, if it happens. You know, that's going to be a national tragedy, and there's going to be, I think, an uproar across the country. But we're finding out, for example, going back to May, when Trump was down in Bedminster about to play golf with Greg Norman, the Australian golfer, and it was rained out, so he stuck indoors with Ivanka, Jared, and Stephen Miller, and he's fuming like crazy about Comey, and that's when he writes this screed that now the special prosecutor has gotten hold of that was written by Stephen Miller. But what was alarming about what we're learning about that was that Jared and Ivanka and Stephen Miller, these are his close advisors, all advised Trump to fire Comey because they thought that the Democrats would think that was a great move because they were so angry at Comey for sabotaging Hillary Clinton's presidential presidency or possible presidency or her election, shall I say. So if that's true, the kind of idiots that he's listening to, who these neophyte spoiled kids who don't know a goddamn thing about the world except their own sort of little avaricious circle of fashion and privilege, if that's who he's listening to, we're in big trouble.
Well, that's absolutely right. And I think, on these weighty foreign policy issues, there is just an amazing projection of concern coming from people like Mattis and Tillerson. I mean, you know, Mattis, I can't recall another occasion in my lifetime where a Secretary of Defense has directly contradicted his president on important questions of policy relating to North Korea, moreover, within hours, and done it in just a direct matter of fact way. And Tillerson the same. So I think a large part of their concern comes from their own apprehension that they just may not be in a position to actually influence his decisions, because his decisions are taken spur of the moment without convening his experts for advice. And this man does have his finger on the nuclear button.
Well, I think the indications are that Tillerson, the Secretary of State, is not going to last much longer, and that Nikki Haley, the UN ambassador, wants that job in any case. But in general, my sense is that, is it possible, just in closing, is it possible that Putin could reinvent himself as the global statesman? I'm the sober steward of the nuclear button. America's run by a madman. We got to take his finger off the button. The very argument that the Democrats should be making, I think, because that's the ultimate responsibility. The fate of the world is in the hands of somebody that appears to be a delusional sociopath. So is that a possible? Could Putin reinvent himself, go from being the arsonist to the fire brigade, and basically come across as a global, sober leader?
I think there's a possibility of that, but there's not a clear path to it yet. And I think in the Kremlin right now, I think they're weighing some sort of initiative in this area, but they don't want to weigh in and do it unless they think there's a good chance of success. And I think if you look back at the behavior of Pyongyang over many generations now, there's no way you can be confident in success in such an initiative.
Well, Scott Horton, I thank you very much for joining us. These are very troubling times, and in the short term, they're not going to get any better. And it's extraordinary to think that there could be a war, a nuclear war in this day and age. But it's not out of the question.
Absolutely not. Well, great to be with you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining recent revelations that Russian election hacking efforts were much more widespread and invasive than previously thought.